Accession number 18758, reel 1.
This is a joint interview with John Smith and George Bain, who flew Avro Yorks on the Berlin airlift. It's recorded by Rodney Giesler on the 15th of October 1999 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Well, gentlemen, could we start with you, George?
Yes, sir.
And could you give me a bit of your story up to before the Berlin airlift? When were you born, for instance?
In the 1st of January 1922, which dates me a bit.
And can you tell me a bit about your family background, what your father did and so on?
Oh, yes, my father was an iron moulder, working in one of the big factories producing tea machinery, really, and in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And then when I was 16, I applied for and took the exam for the civil service and was appointed into London, which I wasn't very keen on. It was very poorly paid and long distance to travel. However, when the war started, the branch I was in, which was in Air Ministry, was moved up to Harrogate, where they took over the hotels and sort of filled them with all the sorts of stuff that they were needed up there. And it was an excellent thing, really, from my point of view as a lad about 18. You know, all the people I knew were moved up together and weren't scattered all over London as they had been before. They were all run together, and it was much pleasant, very pleasant indeed. But, you know, I began to get the itch about flying, and I joined the Air Force. And from then on, just I seemed to go on training forever.
When did you join the RAF?
I joined the RAF in 1941, I think. And, it was one of these things where the training took an immense amount of time. They kept on sort of going halfway through a particular requirement and then decided, no, they didn't need as many as all that, and they put me out to something else. But I ended up going, first of all, down to Cornwall for one of the training stations there, you know, just cadets. And from there, we went to Canada, where I stayed for nearly 2 years. It wasn't my choice, but they kept
on... Were you instructing,
No, I was learning to sort of pole the aircraft. Mm-hmm. We didn't see an airplane for about the first year. And after that, we stayed... Well, I was posted into Coastal Command after a course on the Hudson, which was, it wasn't a popular airplane, but it was doing a job. So I came back having passed out as a qualified on Hudsons, came back to the UK, and never saw a Hudson again.
Didn't you ditch in one?
Yes, I did. That was in Canada. It was, I think it was about the third or fourth trip that I'd done in a Hudson. So I knew little or nothing about the aeroplane, and as the three members of my crew, none of them knew anything about it either. And it was one of these sort of, the aircraft never stopped if they could avoid it. As we landed and sort of taxied in, there was another crew waiting to climb on. But in this particular case, I was the one who climbed on, and I didn't know enough about the aeroplane to sort of check what the fuel consumption was and how much fuel there was. And unfortunately, I knew we had changed the fuel cocks over to put on another tank. But at the time that the engine sort of said, not enough fuel, and started sort of just running quietly down, the other three members of the crew were down the back, and I was no nearer to the control of the fuel tanks than I am to John now. And of course, the aircraft had no way of stabilizing itself, so I had to stay there shouting to them to come back up, They didn't come back up in time, so all I could do was go down, which was rather fortunate, really, because I hit my head sort of as I touched down. We didn't use straps much those days, because they were cumbersome things, and they didn't make a great deal of an issue of it. So when we hit the sea, this was in the Cobequid Bay, on the Canadian coast, and I went out like a light for about, a minute or two, by which time the gunner down the back end had got out of his turret, and he'd pulled the dinghy cord, which inflated upside down. He didn't know whether upside down or not. I thought he couldn't swim. I found out afterwards he was quite a good swimmer, but he decided he wasn't going to get into that cold water, so he jumped for the dinghy and got in there, and the navigator got out on the other side of the aircraft and went out to the far wingtip for some peculiar reason. And the other wireless operator, in fact, a fellow called Bill Dixon, he came and got me out from my seat and dragged me down towards the back, by which time I'd come round again. And he helped me into the dinghy, and there we were, stuck with the dinghy upside down. We didn't know enough about that to realise just what it meant. What it meant was all the things that we could use were underneath. Now, I decided at the time that this was fairly important, so I thought, well, better try and get it out. So I got out into the water. Now, this is the 11th of November, and the Canadian coast is not warm. I got out, and as I was getting in, the crew saw my face turning blue with the cold and dragged me back in again. So that was the end of the way of getting hold of something that we could use. We had no paddles, no anything, and nothing to blow it up with, which was rather a hairy thing. But eventually it became a bit darker, and we saw activity. We weren't all that far away from camp, probably about 15 miles, I suppose, down the bay.
Did you get a distress call out?
No, we didn't have any time at all. We're on our low level exercise at about 200 or 300 feet at the time when the engines gave up, and that was it. But the thing that was important was that nobody was seriously injured, because mostly they went down like a chunk of rock. But for some reason, I didn't break there was a bomb aimer's window on the bottom of it, and it was about that sort of angle, and that was just enough to sort of getting a really serious jolt, and so I just skidded. It eventually broke, but by that time it was almost stopped, and the aircraft wasn't too bad. But when we got in the dinghy, we then found that this rather sad thing about equipment faced us. And we could see later on, about 2 hours afterwards, we saw aircraft searching for us. Never got anywhere near us. Not even close. Until eventually, what are they called? What's the Army Cooperation?
The Lysander.
Yeah, that's right. That came out with the OC of the wing on it, and flew overhead, and we waved frantically and so on, and he passed over about 200 feet to one side and about 100 feet high in the air, and just went on.
Was that the next day?
That was that same day. Mm. If he'd seen us, it would have been very simple. But eventually, it got darker and we got colder, and there was a grating sound. It had been going on for some time, and none of us were sure what it was. But eventually, there was a loud hiss, and one of the gunners was sitting right by this, and the oxygen bottle, or the air bottle for blowing the dinghy up, had a knurled knob on the top, which was grating across the the canvas, the rubberized canvas. And that was it. It worked its way through. Well, he was quick as lightning. He stuck his finger in the hole, which was managed to stop it. It was big enough. And so we didn't lose air at any speed. We were a bit concerned by this time because we really were getting cold. And eventually I felt something underneath me. I wasn't sure what it was. It immediately leaped to mind, fish of some sort, maybe big ones. But it wasn't. It was some sandbar. And it was pitch black by then. And of course our relief was so great that we took no precautions, whatever. We just sort of... I got out first and found I was only up a little above my knees in water. And we all got out and set off where we thought the shore was, which in fact it was. And fortunately, there was no deep water between us and the thing. There could have been. It could have been just a sandbar. We realized all this afterwards.
You left the dinghy behind then?
Oh, yes.
We
wanted land, never mind dinghies.
Fantastic story. Can I come to you now, John, and ask you really the same question, when you were born and what you did before the Berlin airlift?
Right. Well, I was born in October 1926. My father was a ship's caulker.
Ship's caulker?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was a master caulker in London. Mm-hmm. And I was born in Rotherhithe, in London's Dockland. George, as it happens, was born in Belfast Dockland. That's another story. Typical Dockland childhood. Eventually, from the elementary school, I won a scholarship to a grammar school. That was in 1938. In 1939, the war started, and I became an evacuee. And my secondary grammar schooling was from 1939 to 1944 as an evacuee in Sussex. The two things I wanted to do when I was a lad was to fly and to travel. The only way I could get to fly was to join the Air Force. Somebody started a war, there was a good opportunity to do that, and hopefully I should travel once I got flying. So that by the time I was in the sixth form in 1944, I was recruited by a travelling selection board, an ancient Air Commodore who was sent around the schools to inspire young gentlemen to join the Royal Air Force. So I provisionally signed on then. And by the time I became, I had finished my schooling and was actually physically able to join the service, I was enlisted in 1944, November 1944. I was accepted for aircrew, but at that time the casualty rate among aircrew had fallen off dramatically. So they then had a great backlog of people awaiting flying training. So from 1944 through to the end of the war in 45, I was on what is called deferred service, recalled periodically to places like Torquay for reselection, where we went through the whole selection process again as part of the whittling down of the backlog.
Where did you spend your time in between these recalls?
I was a business student at Selfridges.
So you actually took a uniform off and went back to Civic Street?
Oh, yeah. I've been paid by three people. The Selfridges, the Ministry of Labour, and somebody else. I forget now.
RAF or not?
Yeah, it must have been. But they still owe me 3 days' pay because I signed on a Wednesday, but I wasn't inducted until the Friday officially. So for 3 days I was on the books and got no money for that. That's something out of the past.
I never heard of this, actually being returned to Civvy Street. I mean,
well, it's a question of, was I in the service or was it a civilian? I was a member of the RAFVR, automatically, once I was signed on. And then because the training schools were full, literally, we were held in a great pool, and that pool was periodically whittled down. And eventually the war ended in August, and I was then full-time in the service. There was no prospect of flying training at that time because... they didn't need anybody. And anyway, everyone else wanted to get out of the service, and I was trying to get in, which is a very strange situation. And I was given the opportunity of taking on a variety of ground trades, none of which I thought was acceptable until I was persuaded that if I came in as a clerk, I could wait and at the appropriate time would be offered aircrew training. Now, that promise was made by somebody who really didn't have the ability to guarantee it, but in the turmoil at the time, I thought, well, we'll give it a chance. So I actually became a clerk at the record office in Gloucester, which is perhaps the best place I could have been, because the service was peculiar at that time. The overwhelming majority of people serving didn't want to be in the service, and the routine jobs were more than just a chore. They had been doing them for some time, and all they wanted was art, which meant that anyone with any issue at all could have tremendous influence on decisions that were taken. And it so happened that among those of us at Gloucester, there were quite a number of aircrew awaiting training, and by devious means, most of us ended up on flying training. I ended up on the first of what was called the all-through flying training courses in 1947, after the war. Hitherto, aircrew pilot trainees, anyway, had done a system of grading to see whether or not they could fly, and then elementary flying training, followed by service flying training, followed by advanced flying training at a number of different schools, each school specialised. The scheme was changed, and on number one course, which I joined in 1947, we did everything at once. I had no flying experience before I went there, and when I finished, I passed out with my wings. And I passed out in August or September of 1948. Now, it so happened that the Berlin had lifted just started. But it didn't mean much to us at that time, because once you're in a flying training environment, that's all that matters. The world could stop and we wouldn't really know about it. But among my preferences, having analysed what had gone on during the war, and the stories were now coming out about what Bomber Command had been like, dreadful experience, what the maritime forces have been up against, terrible casualty rate, and a rather pointless existence. And it occurred to me the best thing you could do was to fly transport airplanes, because here we come flying to travel. So I said, I want to fly transport airplanes. Thought no more about it, and quite suddenly was posted to Swinderby, which was the Wellington OCU, AFS, I forget what the designation was at that time. Finished at Swinderby in, I think it was November 1948, and was promptly posted to RAF Lynham, 206 Squadron, on Yorks. Ideal. 206 was one of those participating in the airlift, and in fact, at the time I joined them, they were all over in Germany anyway.
Before we actually get to the airlift, can I ask you, George, about how you spent the time between your coastal command time on Hudson's and so on, and the start of the Berlin airlift?
Yes, well, they. I had, I would say, a great deal of luck. Now, the Hudson's, they gave up because they weren't very useful at all.
What was the matter with them exactly?
Oh, they were a civilian airliner really, and they could put a turret on, but that's about all they could do. And they had a bit of a bomb bay, but it wasn't very big either. And their range wasn't particularly good. So when they could replace them, which they did with the Beaufort, and the Beaufort was a torpedo bomber, and they replaced it with that, and I was posted from... When I came back from Canada after this debacle, I was sent to Harrogate to be reposted, and I waited there for about three or four months, which I enjoyed heartily, I must say. But then I was posted to Northern Ireland, to a place called Longkesh, on the Beaufort. And the Beaufort record for a crew killer was pretty high, to put it mildly. They weren't fast, and they were on torpedo work, which meant flying absolutely dead straight and level at a precise height and a precise speed. Otherwise, you were wasting your torpedo before you even dropped it. So that, well, the number that were shot down, because they were predictable, the Germans knew exactly what they were going to do and lined up ready for them when they did, that was it. So I think the loss rate was phenomenally high. They kept on losing Beauforts. And by the time I was passed out on Beauforts, they decided they'd give it up. So I've forgotten how it was. I posted to
you never that. Flew any Beaufort ops then?
No.
No.
No, I was fully equipped for it, but I never had to do it. I was quite glad to say. From that, I went to... Oh, was it? Oh, yes, I was posted to an OTU to be trained on the new aircraft that was coming in, the Warwick, which was the Wellington, sort of rather bigger Wellington. And I converted onto that and eventually was posted out to Malta in 43, somewhere about that, on an air rescue squadron. We covered most of the Mediterranean. But there were no operations by that time in the Med. They'd all moved up, getting up towards the north of Italy. They hadn't got to France yet, but we did see a bit of activity, but not very much. And I just stayed on the Warwick until the war ended, and we were still waiting out there. And eventually, I was demobbed. So I went back to the civil service, into the same job I'd been doing before, and that was in London, which was a...
This was called the Air Ministry, was it?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. And I was in supply, well, the equipment branch of it. And I did a couple of years there, and I was, you know, really a dead job because nothing was being bought. It was getting rid of stuff, and very little could be done with what they had. So eventually, I decided that I'd go back in if I had the chance to get in on reasonable terms. And it wasn't very good at that time. It was a 4-year short service commission they were giving. But they extended that shortly afterwards to 8 years. And I thought, well, I'll take a chance on that. So I applied for and got back into the Air Force as a flying officer. Flight lieutenant, actually, and then they dropped everybody a rank, so I went back to being a flying officer. And from then on, I was just, to start with, they were looking for holes to put people in. But I eventually became a flying instructor, on several types of aeroplanes. And I stayed on that for quite a long time, till where did I get to from there? I went to CFS, Central Flying School, where I was posted to Turnhill as a flying instructor, and from there I went to another place down Cerny, right, South Cerny.
Just up the road.
Yes, that's right. And from there, well, I had a rather hairy experience there. It was quite funny. You want to listen to the funny bit or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, sure, carry on.
I always liked to go on leave and to come back, not on Monday, but if I could come back on a Tuesday or something, and settle down a little easier. And I came back off my leave, by which time my wife and I were living in we had a couple of rooms in a farm, about 6 miles away from South Cerny. Anyway, when I came back on the Tuesday to work, I'd missed the Monday, and on the Monday they'd done a practice flypast with eight aircraft in two sets of four. And they'd done a couple of rehearsals the day before, and one of the chaps didn't turn up that day for work. So they said, "Oh, you better do it." I said, "What'll they do?" "Oh, well, fine, you'll pick it up as you go along." So I did pick it up. We went along.
What aircraft were these, you find?
This was the Prentice.
Mm.
Not a renowned airplane. Anyway, I got to the first aircraft that I was given to join the mob, all taxiing out. it wouldn't start. The engine wouldn't start. So they actually got airborne before I got started. And I met up with them. I knew where they were going, and I headed for them. And they were flying fairly low level, well, about 1,000, 1,200 feet. They were flying over Fairford, which we didn't know at the time, but when we looked down, we could see, I joined the formation by this time, and when we looked down, we could see that this place was alive with people, rather like this, you know, the big shows they put on. This wasn't, it was a commanding general of SAC had come over to accept Fairford for the RAF, the
USAF.
USAF.
Yeah.
And he was orbiting at about 30,000 feet, keeping well out of the way, and the crowd was all the wives and children of everybody, American or anything to do with the Americans, to see this great thing happen. And we came flying over it, and at about 1,000 to 1,200 feet, it's not very high. And there's a blank come somewhere. I remember looking over my shoulder and seeing a pillar about, well, it wouldn't have been as far away as that overhead light there from me.
About 15 feet, yeah.
Yeah. And by the time I saw this, the thing was starting to sort of chop my tail up. And sort of thought, well, no place for me. So I left the airplane quite hastily, very conscious of the fact that we weren't very high. So I didn't do any counting up to three or anything. That's all. As soon as I get hold of the ripcord, I did. And I'll swear, the distance between me and the ground when the parachute actually opened wouldn't have been more than about 20 feet at best. And we were still going down then, but fortunately, when it opened with a sort of whip-like thing, and I was jerked up so that my feet were up and then swung down again, and by that time, I hit the ground with my feet. So you can imagine the margin for safety was not great. Well, I landed on the actual runway at Fairford, and, as you can imagine, the Americans are quite excitable people. And I sat there downwind of the first, in the front half of my aircraft, which was burning merrily with the fuel tanks and so on. I wasn't much further away than I am from that window, but I felt more like sitting down than moving. And it wasn't banging, it was just burning. So I just sat there for a little bit, and was in the smoke, downwind of it, of course. And I began to sort of get my senses together, and I heard a pounding of feet, heavy boots. And through the smoke, and a little to one side of the flame, there was an enormous American with heavy boots on. And the boots sort of sparked as he stopped. And he said, "Geez, if I was you, Bud, I'd get the hell out of here," and turned and disappeared as fast as he could go. And by that time, I was beginning to get my senses together a bit, so I stood up and found that I could stand up, and my one foot was sore, but that was all. And I got rid of the parachute, and I looked along, and the smoke had thinned a bit. And I could see, to my absolute horror, coming up the runway and going like bats out of hell, there were hundreds of cars, literally, and they were coming as fast as they could go. And ahead of them was a Jeep, which I didn't know anything about the Jeep at the time, but the Jeep beat them to me, and it was the RAF station commander, and he said, "Come on, for God's sake, get into this Jeep quick." And I did, and he went off across the grass where they didn't follow him. Otherwise, they'd have probably sort of run me down. And he took me into the sick quarters, asked me what I felt like, and I told him about this foot. So he got it x-rayed. By this time, the place was filling up. Anybody who was any excuse for being in there came. And after a very short time, they decided, well, I was pretty well all right, that they'd better take me over to the officers' club, which they did. They proceeded to fill me without much opposition on my part, I assure you.
Who bumped into you?
It was one of the formation. We never sorted out exactly what
happened.
Yes. We never found out exactly what happened. People were concentrating on sort of position in relation to the other aircraft, you know, the next one to them. But we never found out exactly what caused it. And that was it. But it was...
So Curtis LeMay was delayed, was he, in his arrival? Was it Curt LeMay?
He had to go away. They wouldn't let him land.
Oh, really?
Because the runway had, a bit of damage on it from my aircraft.
Well, that made it beast, I'm sure.
I bet it did. But anyway, it resulted in a very firm friendship between South Cerny and the people at Fairford.